This podcast is an unedited excerpt from an MCLE program presented at MCLE's Conference Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Get 24/7 instant access to over 400 estate planning and administration e-lectures and more with a subscription to the MCLE Online Pass. Learn more at www.mcle.org/onlinepass. Please note that MCLE's products, services, and communications are offered solely as an aid to developing and maintaining professional competence. The statements in this recording may not apply to your circumstances, and no legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice is being rendered by MCLE or its speakers. For full terms and conditions, please see the MCLE website.
Generally, when we talk about long-term care planning, what we mean is planning to protect assets from Medicaid and MassHealth. So for those of you who may not have done any long-term care planning yet or are just generally unfamiliar with Medicaid and MassHealth, what is that? It's essentially the same thing. It's a government program that provides benefits to elderly and disabled individuals. There's a wide range of benefits provided, both for community care and long-term nursing home care. Medicaid is federally and state funded, so it's funded by the federal government, and it's also states contribute. The federal component is obviously called Medicaid, and then in Massachusetts, we refer to it as MassHealth. As a condition of states receiving the federal dollars, they have to essentially follow the federal Medicaid statute or can be no more restrictive than what the Medicaid statute requires. I think for your purposes, that becomes really important. As Leo, I'm sure, can attest to, all the different various fights that we get into with the Medicaid agency as long-term care planning practitioners, a lot of it boils down to the fact that MassHealth many times tries to be more restrictive or implement their regulations in a more restrictive way than what the federal Medicaid statute allows. But that's kind of the overarching scheme of how the program is governed. Like I said, MassHealth is a state component. There is a range, like what is MassHealth? It's a huge program. It provides a wide range of services for both long-term care and community care. Obviously, the most planning opportunities arise in the long-term care end of things. That's where you're talking about individuals needing care in a nursing facility for an extended period of time. And that's where I'm going to go over the basic rules and, basic financial requirements. That's where you run into a lot of the issues with having to spend down assets, all the assets being subject to estate recovery, and so forth. There are also a lot of community care options out there, and I would advise all of you who are interested in practicing in this area or who maybe already do to become familiar with the community care options of MassHealth. There's a senior care options, a PACE program. There's some MassHealth pays for some form of assisted living, so there's a lot out there to help keep people out of nursing homes. And those rules can be very tricky and complicated as well. For those of you who are going to practice in this area, I always tell people it's a good idea, to not only, obviously, MCLE is a great resource, but also, we are all members of MassNALA, the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. And that is a great resource just to provide you some insider knowledge of like what goes on in long-term care planning in terms of Medicaid and MassHealth and all the various changes that are going on in the program that may not be implemented by any rule change. So it may just be like word of mouth. We find out someone gets a denial for something and then that kind of sets off a chain reaction that a new policy of MassHealth. Question.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. I don't want to get off. In the community care options, in terms of those benefits, are they subject to the 5-year transfer restriction?
So the question is, and I can talk about this a little bit more, but the question is if somebody needs community care, are they subject to the 5-year look back that's applicable to long-term care? That's a really good question, and generally the answer is no. However, There was a change implemented that I believe for the frail elder waiver program or some community care programs, they are supposed to be implementing 5-year look back or transfer penalties, similar to how they operate for long-term care. I have not to date experienced that with applications. I don't know if they're enforcing that. I personally haven't experienced that. I don't know, Leo, if you have, if you do a ton of, a lot of community care applications.
We don't, but the message is whatever they can do to deny, because they could throw in a 5-year rule, even though, as Lisa said, it doesn't seem clear from the regs, they'll still do it. And now you're stuck where Lisa is stuck often, and that is advising the family to litigate. But I don't know the specific answer. I just know that just about everything is getting tougher and tougher and tougher.
Yeah, I think that they can for certain community care programs, like specifically the waivers. So you'd have to look into that. And, you know, I advise clients that they can do it, and they haven't been, but that doesn't mean that they can't in the future. And also, too, to keep in mind is a lot of times they'll have, if a client says, well, I want to make a transfer for community, I understand it's not, there's no 5-year look back. I always remind the clients that even if you do this transfer and it works for community MassHealth, it's, you know, if you go into a nursing home in like 2 years, this is going to come up as a problem or an issue, just so that, you know, you have that in writing so the client or the family member doesn't come back to you and say, well, I thought that this was fine. So applying for Medicaid and MassHealth benefits, it's an arduous, obviously, and difficult process. I find generally when clients ask me how long is it going to take, I, you know, tell them months, like, you know, from start to finish. If they're lucky, if it's like an application that goes through without any kind of appeal. If you're looking at like an appeal perspective, I mean, that could take, it literally can take years. Applying for the benefits, it can require up to 5 years of statements for institutional care. So if you're applying for long-term care Medicaid benefits, there's rigid deadlines to meet regarding eligibility and appeal periods. This is a huge issue with Medicaid applications, especially if a family or nursing facility is trying to do the application for the family. Just be aware that there's all sorts of timelines that if they get an adverse notice, they have to appeal within 30 days or they could lose portions of retroactive coverage.
How often would you recommend that the nursing facility do the application?
Probably never.
Right. It's just, oh, they're not going to charge me.
Yeah. I have to try to be.
If they have no money.
Right. If they have no money. I mean, I try to be a little bit, you know, like an optimist, and I try to think they're just trying to help. And I think in many cases the facilities possibly are, but it's just such a minefield. And I think, Leo, too, even with the applications that seem simple or someone has very little money left, that doesn't mean like 3 years ago they couldn't have done a promissory note with a child or they couldn't have loaned a kid $50,000. Like something like this is going to come back to haunt them. Or, you know, I've seen like very, very simple applications done, you know, by non-attorneys that they didn't appeal things properly, and now there's huge gaps of coverage and facilities try to go after family members. You know, I've seen all of this happen. So definitely very challenging area to practice in. And just if you're never going to do a Medicaid application for a client, have no interest, but if you are going to engage in the long-term care planning piece of it, like help them do asset transfers, things like that, just definitely good to be aware of how a Medicaid application works, just from a client perspective, because they're going to ask you questions that implicate a Medicaid application down the line. This is just a slide with an overview of some community benefits. These are all spelled out in the regs, the MassHealth regulations, the 130 CMR, like 520 or 519. Obviously the goal of community is to keep people out of nursing homes. You know, there's a group adult foster care in combination with like an SSI benefit that pays for assisted living. There's a PACE program, which probably many people are aware of, that does a really nice job of providing home care component with like an adult daycare component, senior care options, frail elder waiver, a PCA program. I mean, these are all great programs. I think this varies geographically. Like, I know not all parts of the state have PACE, for example. Each program has their separate qualifications, so you got to check the regulations. And then also check, the MCLE does a great series, the Estate Planning for the Aging and Incapacitated Client. And that is like the Bible of anything you need to know about mass health, and it outlines all the different community programs and all the various income and asset qualification rules for those programs, because it is very different from program to program. So for long-term care mass health benefits, and this, just to be clear, is care in a nursing home, so when somebody needs care in a facility. There is a $2,000 asset limit for a single person, so single individual, divorced, widowed, going into the facility can only have $2,000 in assets. And just to be clear, that doesn't include the house. And I'm going to talk about the house in some later slides, but this doesn't include the house. If it's a married couple, they can have up to $128,640. And I got that from your website, Leo.
That's the right number.
The Medicaid numbers. Leo's firm's website does like this great current numbers. I actually personally always go to it, and you know, this isn't adjusted for inflation every year, so you should check that frequently. There's a lot of different numbers that the MassHealth agency uses, and they're all updated there. In terms of income, the institutionalized spouse, or the individual, the person in the nursing home, all of their income goes to the facility. There's some limited circumstances where the income isn't all paid, you know, by the institutionalized spouse, or some of it shifts over. I thought that was beyond the scope of this presentation, so I'm not getting into that, but that is something to be aware of. So there are certain exceptions to that, specifically like if the spouse at home, if their income is so low, which you do see from time to time, especially if that spouse never worked, some of that income can be shifted over to the spouse at home. They get a very small deduction, personal needs account allowance of $72.80. And they get a deduction, another main deduction that they get is for the supplemental health insurance premium. So, like, I personally always have clients ask me, should I keep, if the husband or wife is going to the nursing home, should I keep their supplemental health insurance? Like, does it even matter? And you always tell them yes to keep it. First of all, it's great to have another payment source, especially if they're in and out of a hospital. They could get some extra services through their supplemental, and MassHealth allows the deduction. So it's like, it doesn't impact them at all, and it's just good to have that extra benefit there. The community spouse keeps his or her income. So their community spouse, if they're working, they're retired, they get to keep all of their income. That doesn't go over for the care costs of the spouse in the facility. Another big rule, that probably everyone's, familiar with is the 5-year look back period. There's a 5-year look back period on transfers. So any kind of transfer, I find generally the rule is it's going to be a transfer that you made for the purpose of qualifying for benefits. And that is what the regulation says. And it's like they have to... Actually, MassHealth has to demonstrate that there was an intent there to make this gift to qualify. So, like, if there was evidence that, yes, you went to an elder law attorney who told you, why don't you, consider transferring $40,000, they didn't make it through the 5 years. I guess that would qualify. In most cases I see, like, 99.9%, where this comes up is, like, the typical, 3 years ago they made a $10,000 or $20,000 gift to a child for wedding, or to help a grandchild go to college, or because a child was having a rough financial time. And MassHealth, usually in my experience, every once in a while I'll get one that just goes through, but they always try to like say that's disqualifying. So those are difficult cases. Those get litigated. They're just tough. I mean, if you lose on appeal or if it does create a problem, essentially it'll cause a period of ineligibility from benefits. So the person gets allowed, but it causes...
I have a question online.
Yep.
And is there a limit as to how much income a person can make and still qualify for long-term care this question really is Massachusetts an income cap state? And I think you answered it already. We have the spouse at home versus the institutionalized.
Yeah. So I guess, so the question is, so I guess if the person in the nursing home, did they have an income cap? So the answer is not really, no. But then you get into the, if I've seen, if they make too much income, so their income would have to be pretty high, and this happens a lot if they are, if they have a long-term care insurance policy that's paying out. MassHealth treats it in these situations as income, even though it's really not. It could push their income up over the Medicaid reimbursement rate. This is like also beyond the scope of this talk, but it's called an over-under type situation, and it doesn't make them ineligible. It just causes a lot of administrative headaches for the facility because they have to like calculate out a deductible. I just dealt with this like very recently, and it was kind of a nightmare. So the answer is not really, but if they do go over, they're not ineligible, and it becomes, you can just push it off because then it becomes more of an issue for the nursing home to figure out.
But the real you can drive a hole through this is the community spouse. Once let's say the spouse in the nursing home is eligible, the community spouse can win megabucks as long as the money doesn't go into a joint account. It's incredibly important to make sure that whatever the spouse at home earns stays in a separate account. And then hopefully, when you did the plan, you created a new will.
Yeah, with a testament.
For that person, okay? So that we don't want the money going back. We get the husband on MassHealth, the spouse at home is accumulating income, doesn't change the will, and then everything goes back over to the husband. Well, that's it. But there's no income cap. It's not like if the spouse at home makes too much money,
right,
the husband's not eligible.
Right.
That's good news, and it's a great planning opportunity, gets you into annuity. So
yep,
that was just a question.
And really interesting point Leo brought up is that they are, once an application is approved for spouses, they're treated under the Medicaid statute as like being separate individuals. And there's a part of the Medicaid statute that actually talks about this. There's like a specific citation, and they're just separate. So like it's true. I mean, if after that approval's in, the community spouse, you know, if they won the lottery or something, then that never comes back to the institutionalized spouse. So that's really, really important to keep in mind. And I am going to talk about the wills with testamentary trust as well. So for the rules regarding the house, so the primary residence, it's non-countable. You have to state, especially on the application, especially, you know, relevant to a single person, that you have an intention to return home. That is very important in order to maintain, you know, the non-countable status of the house. If it's a spousal case, really important for your planning options, if you're going to be helping people with this planning, is if there's a sick spouse in the nursing home and there's a community spouse staying home and they own the house jointly, you have to make sure you take that community spouse off the deed and put it all, excuse me, the sick spouse off the deed and put it into the community spouse's name. So you want to take that ill individual off the deed. Also really important, like in terms of what you can do it for advanced planning to help for this, I think one of the most important things you can impart upon your clients is the fact that they need to have an updated power of attorney that allows gifting or transfers between spouses. Because, you know, if that isn't in there, and the ill spouse, as they most, you know, frequently are when they're in a nursing home, if they are incompetent and there's either no power of attorney or it doesn't allow gifting, on top of everything else you're going to have to help the clients with, you're also going to have to get like a conservatorship for a single transaction to remove the ill spouse from the deed. So just, you know, in terms of your planning, updating your forms, just definitely keep that in mind. I've seen a lot of powers of attorney over the years that have, like, they limit the transfer or the gifting that can be made, like to the annual estate tax exclusion, you know, something like that. So you want to revise that language somewhat, or just look at the form you have in your firm or office. So for the primary residence, the equity limit is $893,000 in Massachusetts. again, the house is, it's not an asset, but that doesn't mean if you're a single person and you have the house in your own individual name when you die, that does not mean it's not subject to estate recovery. This is a really important distinction. So if you, I'm gonna use the example of the single person because this is where it most often comes up. If you are a single person and you are in a nursing home and you're on MassHealth and you have accountable and you have a house, MassHealth allowed the application to go through, so they said, fine, we agree the house is non-countable, we're approving the application. Many times families will say, oh, that means that, you know, the house is protected, nothing can happen to it. MassHealth has an automatic estate recovery lien on that house to the extent it's in that person's sole and individual name. So what that means is when the individual dies and the house has to be probated or a probate petition has to be filed to transfer title of the house and estate recovery is notified, they're going to want to be paid back for all the money that they expended on the individual's care during their lifetime. That's what the estate recovery lien is. And that doesn't go to the fact, it can be non-countable and still subject to estate recovery. I know that's a little bit confusing, but that's kind of...
Earlier today we talked about transferring property to a revocable trust.
Yep.
So if we transfer the house to a revocable trust, it will avoid probate.
Right.
And would avoid the lien. But what's the problem with the house in a trust as opposed to a house in the individual's name?
Yeah. So that's a good point because MassHealth will treat a house in a revocable trust as countable. So they know that if you do that and it avoids probate, you're not getting evading the lien. So they will make you, they will say, take the property out of the revocable trust and put it back in the individual name. Where you can take advantage of planning is if you do an irrevocable trust and you wait the 5-year look back period. And then the house is both non-countable and it's not subject to estate recovery. That, I'm going to talk about the irrevocable trusts, you know, in the next few slides.
You hit them with a couple of good questions there,
yep.
Lisa.
Okay.
Just a quick question, the equity limit. So a lot of my clients have $1.5 million house in Newton that they bought for $50,000. So you don't want to transfer it and lose the stepped up basis, but also there's an equity limit. So that means it is countable?
Yes, it would be countable because to the extent that the equity exceeds the $893,000.
So if you have a client with $1.3 million house,
single person,
you could transfer it to an irrevocable trust, but if it was not, they'd have to pull the equity out of that to pay for a nursing home until they got down below the $893,000.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've dealt with that. I've never dealt with it that much over, but I have dealt with situations like where it's been a couple hundred thousand over the equity, and then the only solution that I can think of is to take the equity out, and then you could do some planning with that money. We could do an annuity if there was a couple, or you know something, or just like a spend down. To get it below, but I don't know if Leo, you've dealt with that.
Well, the problem is if you take the equity out, where are you going to put the money?
Right, because then the money becomes countable.
This gets back to advanced planning, and it should, even though the house is a non-countable asset, it is subject to estate recovery, and therefore it should be an asset that should be transferred to an irrevocable income-only Medicaid trust. Wait out the 5-year, you're going to get your step up in basis because the trust is set up so that the settlor, mother or father, will get the income from that trust for the rest of their lives. That's going to get you the step up. It's the best of all possible worlds. And you don't keep a life estate in the deed. We don't want to do that. We're going to transfer the property right into the trust. You're going to talk about the life estate tables?
Briefly, because I'm just going to talk about the new controversy.
The controversy is this. We talk about MassHealth. Is basically when you transfer a property, let's say, keep it simple, to the children, and you keep a life estate. If that property is sold, a portion of the proceeds has to go to the life tenant. And up until this past year, we always used the IRS tables. You know, someone who was, let's say, 80 years old with a life estate would get about 20% of the property. But MassHealth has now issued new regulations ignoring the IRS tables. Now the amount that would go to the life tenant is more like 40%. They've almost doubled the amount because they're basically taking new tables where people live longer. And so if...
They went back to the Social Security tables, right?
Back to the Social Security
table. Yeah, they went to the Social... They're trying to go back to the Social Security
They want a larger portion of the proceeds to go to the life tenant, which means more money is available to pay for the nursing home. That's the controversy.
Right, and then the other thing they're doing is it's like a new eligibility operations memo, which I think is being challenged in
It's a battle every day.
Right. But I think what they're doing is, like, if you have a client that sold their house 2 years ago and they calculated the life estate value based on the IRS tables, and that's what MassHealth was accepting at the time, mm-hmm. they're going back and saying, oh, that's a disqualifying transfer. And then they're assessing a penalty period based on, like, something you did 2 years ago when it wasn't even a problem. So
That's why people say, I'm just going to take a life estate. I said, no, don't keep a life estate. Just transfer the house to the irrevocable trust. If you think you need a life estate because you don't trust your kids, then forget about it. Yes. Yes. Yes.
If it's joint property, what about the $500,000 exclusion?
Yeah.
On the
great.
Sale trust.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. And yeah, the way the Medicaid trust is set up, it's includable for estate tax purposes because the income has been reserved by the grantor. It is an incomplete gift because the grantor typically reserves the right to designate where the property will go, limited to the kids. And then it's a grantor trust for income tax purposes, which means if the trust sells it, the trust is ignored. So you're going to get the best of all possible worlds. It's a wonderful vehicle, except every time MassHealth looks at a trust, they're trying to find a reason why it somehow violates the rule. Lisa has litigated a lot of these cases, and frankly, so have we. We're going to get into what makes the trust accountable asset. Well, if principal can be used to or for the benefit of the settlor, then the trust assets are considered countable. And now they're looking at the trustee's ability to distribute money to the kids. Well, somehow that equates with...
Mm-hmm. Talk about income. I think of rental income.
Yes.
Personal.
Yeah. It's a good question. The question is, does there really need to be any rent? And the Internal Revenue Code, the answer is no. The 2036 says if property is transferred but the grantor reserves the right to income, you don't have to have income, it's going to be includable in the estate. So the fact that no income is coming in doesn't make a difference. It's going to get the stepped up in basis. Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
And then just one final point, if a client, this is really important to keep in mind, if a client comes to you and they have a long-term care insurance policy that meets certain minimums, it's like, I think $125 a day for at least 2 years of coverage, you should check and make sure that those rules are still current. It will provide an estate recovery exemption. So the house can't be subject to estate recovery if they have a qualifying long-term care. Now, Medicaid also likes to play around with this exception because, I apparently, for a few years they were trying to argue that if you had used all the policy when you got to the nursing home, then they weren't going to allow the estate recovery exemption. I'm not sure if that, I think
they changed that.
They changed then it was like languishing. So, my understanding is if it's good to have at least some of the policy left when you're going into the nursing home. And just the other tricky thing with this is, where at the top part I say, you should always state there's an intention to return home. If you are trying to meet this exemption on the long-term care insurance policy, you actually have to say on the application you don't have an intent to return home.
Mm-hmm.